From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, Aziz Ansari talks about co-writing and starring in season 2 of his Netflix comedy series, Master of None. Some storylines are based on his life as a first-generation Indian American whose parents are Muslim, like the flashback scene when he's a kid eating at a friend's house and is served bacon, only to be told by his mother that it's against their religion.
And I remember being very upset because I was really enjoying it. Maybe that's why I don't like religion, because the first introduction to it was, oh, you don't get to do that thing you just discovered that you really enjoy.
Also, the editor of the New York Times Book Review, Pamela Paul, talks about her job and her own new memoir about her life as a reader. And Ken Tucker reviews new albums by Harry Styles of One Direction and Dan Auerbach of the Black Keys. First news. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Aziz Ansari, co-created, co-wrote, and stars in the Netflix comedy series Master of None. All 10 episodes of season 2 are now available. Ansari previously co-starred in Parks and Recreation, and he's a comic. He hosted Saturday Night Live the day after President Trump was inaugurated. We'll talk about his opening monologue a little later. Let's start with Master of None. Ansari plays Dev, who, like Ansari, is the son of two immigrants from India who are Muslim. Dev's parents are played by Ansari's parents. The series is about Dev's life as a first-generation Indian-American trying to bridge the cultural gap between himself and his parents, trying to find a place for himself in the entertainment world, where there aren't many parts for brown actors, and trying to find a woman with whom he can have a meaningful relationship. In season 2, Dev is recovering from a breakup. He's striking out with dating apps. He might be falling in love with a good friend, but she's engaged. As for Dev's career, he gets a job hosting a cupcake competition show on a food channel. In the episode titled Religion, Dev, his parents, and his visiting aunt, uncle, and cousin go to a restaurant. Dev's parents have urged him to act like he's religious and prays every day so as not to offend the relatives. But Dev gives up on that pretense and orders pork. After the dinner, his parents are angry. His mother speaks first.
I can't believe you did this.
Uncle and auntie were very offended.
Well, I'm sorry they're offended, but you know what? I'm not religious, and I don't think it's right to pretend to be.
What do you mean you are not religious?
It's just not for me.
What's not for you?
Well, there's definitely issues. What about all the stuff with women?
What is this, Fox News? Why am I under attack?
Pada, you know we don't believe that. Some people have bad interpretations.
Yeah. And, you know, you guys have your interpretations, right? You eat non-halal, you used to smoke cigarettes, you don't wear the hijab. Why can't I have my interpretation where I'm just nice and I eat pork?
It's not funny.
Look, I get it. For you guys, the religion has this cultural value. It's not like that for me. It's people calling me terrorists and getting pulled out of airport security lines.
That's because you lost your passport 3 times.
I lost it twice.
No, 3 times.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to talk about this anymore. I'm really disappointed in you. I'm going to bed.
We could have gone to the seafood place. None of this would have happened.
Really? That's your takeaway after all this? That we should have gone to the seafood place?
Yep. Good night.
Aziz Ansari, welcome back to Fresh Air. And congratulations on season 2 of Master of None. So is it this little episode that we just heard based on something that happened to you?
The real thing that happened is that it's even sillier than what happened in the show. The real thing that happened was I was in a relationship at the time, and me and the woman I was seeing, we were at dinner with my parents, and she didn't know about the whole pork thing. And she ordered a dish that had pork in it. And I saw it, and I was like, well, I want to eat some of that. And I had a second where I was like, well, I don't want to eat in front of my parents. They might get upset. And then I thought, well, what am I talking about? I'm in my 30s. I can do what I want to do. I can eat what I want. And so I ate some of this pork, and my mom got a little upset with me. Not at the level that the character in the show gets upset, but she wasn't too pleased about it. The next day, I was walking around with this girlfriend I had at the time, and we went to just go get like a bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich. And she's like, hey, I don't know if we should get a bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich. Your parents seem kind of upset they eat pork. And I said, it's fine. What are we going to run into them on the street? We get the sandwich, and then 2 minutes later, we run into my parents on the street. And my dad's like, what are you eating? Can I have a bite? I was like, no, there's bacon in it. And he was like, okay. And then I had to go do something. And the three of them went off together to go walk around in a park or something. And then my girlfriend at the time texts me about 10 minutes later. And she says, your parents are asking me why I'm peer pressuring you into eating pork. The episode ended up being a totally different story, but just this idea of this conversation about pork and how it segued into a deeper conversation about religion and family and tradition is what was interesting to me. And so me and my brother wrote this episode about that. And it just seemed like an interesting way to get into this whole discussion. And our show has so much stuff about food, it was kind of perfect.
Do you remember the first time you ate pork? Was it served to you or did you seek it out?
It's actually exactly what happens in the first scene of that episode. That is a direct from Aziz's life to the screen moment where I was a little kid. I was at this other kid's house and they were eating bacon and I was eating it and I'd never had it before. And I thought it was so good. And my mom called me. It's exactly like what's in the show. I don't even know if my mom, I got to talk to my mom and ask her if she remembers the phone call when I was a little kid. But she called me and she said, Aziz, what are you doing? And I was like, oh, I'm just here eating bacon. And she was like, oh, bacon is pork. We're Muslims. Muslims aren't supposed to eat pork. And I remember being very upset because I was really enjoying it. And maybe that's why I don't like religion. Because the first introduction to it was, oh, you don't get to do that thing you just discovered that you really enjoy.
So were you raised within the Muslim tradition?
You know, I was never really that religious, and I grew up in South Carolina, so it was kind of hard to participate in the religion because there was no mosque or anything like that. So I was never really religious. I never really took to religion in general. I just remember being a kid and even having the thought of like, well, it seems like everyone's just doing whatever their parents' religion was. It never seemed like any parent went and like read all the religious books and said, well, I'm not really into Buddhism or Taoism. Christianity is the one for me. It just seemed like everyone just did what their parents did. So that immediately made me skeptical of the whole thing, even as a kid. So I never was really into religion as a concept.
So I love, you know, we talked about this the last time you were on the show, that you've cast your parents to play Dev's parents, your character's parents in the series, and they're great in it. I'm wondering if working together on this series has brought you together more.
I would say it has. We just spend more time together from doing it. They don't live in New York, you know, they live in North Carolina.
Right.
And, you know, my dad told me this really touching thing last year when we finished the season. After the season aired, my dad came to New York and we went on the Stephen Colbert's show together. And we were both guests on it. It was very fun. And we went out to dinner afterwards and he was telling me, like, yeah, this is all fun and, you know, it's great to, you know, go on the show with you and everything, but, you know, the reason I'm acting in the show and doing all this is just to spend more time with you and to see you. And it really hit me because, you know, my dad is a practicing gastroenterologist. My mom works at the office. When they come to do the series, they're using their vacation time to help me. My mom doesn't even like acting in the show. She's really just doing it because she loves me very much. She hates acting. She's already like, before the second season, when we announced the second season, it's like, okay, this season the mom character's on vacation or, you know, she's just gone, you know. And I was like, well, she can't be on vacation the whole time. She's like, no, well, maybe she's at a wedding sometimes. She just didn't want to be a part of it. But she did it because, you know, she loves me and my brother's also heavily involved with the show. And it's a really special thing that we get to do this together. My entire immediate family worked on that episode. I mean, my brother's with me all the time when we do the show, but for that episode, the religion episode, you know, my parents are acting in it. My brother's a writer on set. We wrote the episode together, and we're making this project that I'm very proud of, and to do that with your entire immediate family, it's a very rare pleasure.
So one of the episodes, the Thanksgiving episode, takes place over the course of several years, from your character Dev's childhood through the present. And every few minutes, it's like it's another year. And every Thanksgiving, since his parents are from India, they don't celebrate Thanksgiving. So every Thanksgiving, Dev goes to his best friend Denise's home and has Thanksgiving with her mother, her aunt, and her grandmother. And in this episode, when they're kids, she kind of comes out to him. So I want to play that scene in which Denise explains that. Well, let's hear her explain it.
Hey, can I talk to you about something?
Yeah, sure. What's up?
All right, you know Erica?
White Erica or Black Erica?
Nah, mixed Erica.
Oh, yeah, I know mixed Erica. She's cute.
Nah, mixed Erica's fine as hell.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. Like, I like her. I have a crush on her.
Wait, are you trying to tell me that you're, you know...
Lebanese?
Wait, you're from Lebanon?
No, I don't know how to... I'm not comfortable with the word, lesbian.
All right, so we'll say you're Lebanese. I mean, I always thought there was a good chance. You're the only girl who wore Jordans to the spring fling. And you got those Jasmine Guy posters up for years. I always felt like it wasn't about her acting.
And I have been dressing like the brat since preschool.
You gonna tell your mom?
Being gay isn't something Black people love to talk about.
Why?
Some Black people think being gay is the choice. And when they find out that their kid is gay, they try to figure out what they did wrong.
Gay Martin's white. His parents did the same thing.
Yeah, but it's more intense for Black folks. All right, so everything's a contest for us. And your kids are like trophies. Me being gay is like tarnishing her trophy.
I don't think being Lebanese tarnishes the trophy. There's plenty of straight trophies. I think it's cool you're a Lebanese trophy.
Thanks, dude.
Damn, this has been an intense talk. If you want to smoke some weed, I got some that's dank.
Okay, and that was Suraj Partha playing the 16-year-old Dev and Eden Duncan Smith playing the 16-year-old Denise. So,
does the bleep guy always get excited when I get booked as a guest? He's like, finally, I can use my bleeps.
So this is, in part, I think, the story of Lena Waithe, who plays the adult Denise and is a recurring character in the series. And
she co-wrote the episode with me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We wrote the episode together, and a lot of it is her mining her own story.
How did you decide to have her tell part of her story in an episode?
Because I know when someone that's not you tries to tell your story, especially when you don't look like the person whose story you're trying to tell, you're going to screw it up. And the only way to get it right is to have them be as involved as possible. And that's why I told her from the get-go, I said, you need to write this with me. And I'll help you, and we'll get this in shape and make it feel like the show. But you've got to make sure we get this right. If I wrote that by myself, what am I going to... That episode, it's just me and four Black women, the whole episode. I joked with Melina, who directed the episode, and Lena was like, this is the most amount of screen time I've seen on any film or television show with one Indian character and four Black women. So how am I going to write that episode by myself? It would be offensive, you know?
You got to answer.
I guess I don't have the gall of of all those white writers that write for minorities. I wanted to have her be involved as possible. And I wanted to have Melina Matsoukas, also African-American, direct the episode. And I wanted to have those two women make sure we got this right.
My guest is Aziz Ansari. He co-created, co-writes, and stars in the Netflix comedy series Master of None. All of season 2 is now available. We'll hear more of our conversation after a break, and Ken Tucker will review new solo albums by Harry Styles and Dan Auerbach. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with Aziz Ansari. He co-created, co-writes, stars in, and directs some episodes of the Netflix comedy series Master of None. The main character, like Ansari, is the son of immigrants from India who are Muslim. He also co-starred in the NBC series Parks and Recreation and has been doing stand-up comedy since his college days. So I want to ask you about hosting Saturday Night Live the day after mm-hmm. President Trump was inaugurated. When did you find out that you would be hosting the day after Inauguration Day?
I found out a month before. I directed the last two episodes of the season, and I wanted to get my edits, the director's cut of it, done before I went away somewhere for a Christmas break. And so I finished it, and I was like, okay, now I just got to go somewhere and get away. It was a very intense shoot for me, and it took a lot out of me. And then the day I finished, I went to some Christmas party, and I ran into the talent booker from SNL, and she's like, I've been trying to call you all day. We want you to host next month. And I was like, great. And, you know, part of me was like, ah, I wanted to just go away. But hosting SNL has always been a dream of mine, and I was so excited for the opportunity that I didn't care. And the next day, I just started going to the comedy club, and I started working harder than I ever have at stand-up to try to get this set in order for the show in January.
Did you feel like a responsibility to make the set political in some way and a response to the election and the inauguration?
Yeah, I think there was some expectation that I was going to have some take on this. And it was a lot of pressure, you know, even from friends of mine in my own life. They're like, man, you better do something amazing. You know, people are going to be watching.
No pressure.
You know, it's such it's been one of the most popular seasons of SNL ever. Everyone's watching the show for their take. And, you know, I think there was this expectation of, okay, well, Aziz is going to have some take on this. And it's a really tricky task because everyone's talking about him and the whole situation. So it's a challenge to find a take that feels unique and sharp and original enough. But I had that whole month and I just did so many sets. And, you know, I had no material. I had no material that I'd been working on because I'd been making the show, and all the other material I had, I'd put in a stand-up special. So I had little pieces here and there, but they weren't about him. But slowly but surely, the set evolved, and I ended up with what I did, and I was really happy with it.
So let's hear the very beginning of the set. So this is Aziz Ansari on January 21st, hosting Saturday Night Live.
Thank you very much. Wow, I can't believe this. I'm here hosting Saturday Night Live. Yeah. The day after Trump's inauguration. Pretty cool to know, though, he's probably at home right now watching a brown guy make fun of him, though, right?
Okay, so that was your opening. So when you were testing out material at comedy clubs, like, you couldn't test that out because that was like a unique Saturday Night Live kind of joke. That whole joke is based on Trump watching you at Saturday Night Live. So there must have been material like you couldn't test at the comedy clubs before doing it live.
What's interesting about doing SNL is no matter how many times you practice in a comedy club, it's happening that day. So with the whole election and inauguration, everyone's mood was changing, you know, every day, and crazy things were happening every day. So you never knew what you were going to be in for that Saturday. You know, the day before on the inauguration, everyone was so down and depressed. The whole mood on the set was so bad. And then the next day, on Saturday, there was the Women's March, and everyone's spirits were boosted, and it was a totally different environment. And no matter how many times you practice in a comedy club, being there at SNL at that stage, it's not like any comedy club. You know, it's a very strange setup. And it's really just about what these people think, you know? And you have one rehearsal, and then you do the show, and that's it. And that's what's out there forever, and it's one of the most watched stand-up sets I'll ever do in my life, if not the most. And so there was a lot of pressure on it, but it went really well, and I was really happy with it.
So I want to play another excerpt of your opening monologue on January 21st on Saturday Night Live. Here it is.
So look, we're divided. It's okay. We've always been divided by some of these big political issues. It's fine. As long as we treat each other with respect and remember that ultimately we're all Americans, we'll be fine. But the problem is... there's a new group. I'm talking about this tiny slice of people that have gotten way too fired up about the Trump thing for the wrong reasons. I'm talking about these people that as soon as Trump won, they're like, we don't have to pretend like we're not racist anymore. We don't have to pretend anymore. We can be racist again. Woo! Whoa, 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 whoa. No, no. If you're one of these people, please go back to pretending. You gotta go back to pretending. I'm so sorry we never thanked you for your service. We never realized how much effort you were putting into the pretending, but you gotta go back to pretending. I know it's been a rough couple of years. Obama, Empire, Hamilton. It's just been hit after hit after hit. Star Wars movies where the only white characters are stormtroopers. I get it, it's been rough. But you gotta stop. You know who I'm talking about. There's like this new lowercase KKK movement that started. This kind of casual white supremacy. Oh, let me put my foot in the pool and see how cold this water really is. No, I'm talking about these people that are running around saying stuff like, Trump won, go back to Africa. Trump won, go back to Mexico. They see me. Trump won, go back to where you came from. Yeah, they're not usually geography buffs. Is that the plan, by the way? We're all gonna move, all the minorities, 40-something percent of the country, every minority's gonna move, Beyonce's gonna move.
That's Aziz Ansari the day after Inauguration Day on Saturday Night Live. So when you walked off stage, did you know that you killed? Like, did you know you did really good?
I felt pretty good, yeah. But what's interesting is you don't have very much time to enjoy that moment, because as soon as you finish, these amazing people that work on the show just yank you and pull you and like rip all your clothes off to change you for your next sketch. So, you know, I was like having that moment of like, whew, I did it. Like, that was great. That went as good as it could. And then someone's like, come on, we gotta get you changed. And they yanked me down. But it was super fun. And his name's Donna, who kind of heads your changing and everything. And she was like, you did really good. And it felt great.
So are you going to continue doing stand-up?
In my life, I'd like to think so, yes, but I think I want to take a little breather from it and come back, but I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do now. You know, it's so interesting to me. I do all these interviews, and everyone's always like, well, what's next? What are you going to do now? Are you going to go do stand-up? Are you going to do another season? Are you going to do a movie? What are you doing? It's like, I don't know. Let me just relax for a second. let me just live my life. Forget season 3 of Master None. I'm also doing season 34 of Aziz Ansari. Let me do that a little bit. Let me live a couple episodes.
Well, good luck with your life.
Hey, same to you.
Thank you. And congratulations on season 2. It's terrific.
Thank you very much.
Aziz Ansari co-created and stars in the Netflix series Master of None. All of season 2 is now available. Harry Styles is a member of the teen pop group One Direction, and he's just released his first solo album, which has topped the album charts. Dan Auerbach is one half of the rock act The Black Keys. He's just released a new solo album. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of both new releases, finding common ground in the two musicians' quest for authenticity.
Carolina, so far away, but she says I remind her of home, feeling oh so far from home. She never saw.
Harry Styles presents his first solo album, titled Harry Styles, as Earnest Labor, a skip through eras of pop music that preceded his birth. You can hear how closely he's listened to Queen and T-Rex and David Bowie, and especially Elton John. Listen to the way Styles' first single, Sign of the Times, begins as a turgid ballad, only to take off in a surge of emotion that recalls Elton's Rocket Man.
Just stop your crying, it's a sign of the times. Welcome to the final show. Hope you're wearing your best clothes. You can't bribe the door on your way to the sky. You look pretty good down here, but you ain't really good. We never
That song is already a hit, a chunk of highly effective melodrama that American Idol contestants will be massacring for years to come. Knowing he's got the youth market sewn up, Styles is trying to sell older listeners on his new work. He's following a frayed playbook, one in which you stop in at Rolling Stone magazine to peddle your wares. Rolling Stone complied by enlisting Cameron Crowe, who first came to prominence transcribing the infinite wisdom of the Eagles and Jackson Browne for that magazine in the 70s. Crowe interviewed Styles and confirmed Harry's sincerity to an audience that still views boy bands and pop stars as automatic sellouts.
Same lips red, same eyes blue, same white shirt, couple more tattoos. But it's not you and it's not me. Tastes so sweet, looks so real, sounds like something that I used to feel. But I can touch what I see. We're not who we used to be. We're not who we used to be. We're just two ghosts standing in the place of you and me. Trying to remember how it feels to have a heartbeat.
That's Harry Styles. Now listen to Dan Auerbach, who has spent much of his time in the Black Keys making bluesy rock and roll rooted in earlier eras of hard rock. Waiting on a Song isn't his first solo album, but it's the first one in which he sounds like he wants a big pop hit. If only this was 1972.
I've been thinking, I've been humming, I've been picking and I've been strumming, just waiting, waiting on a song. I've been hitching, I've been thumbing, I can almost hear one coming, I just waiting.
That's the album's title song, a catchy little thing he co-wrote with three other guys, one of whom is the great singer-songwriter John Prine. Auerbach went to Nashville to make this record. He had the means to start his own recording studio there, and he hired a passel of veteran musicians who've played with acts such as Elvis Presley and Duane Eddy to record with him. Heck, Auerbach even hired Duane Eddy himself to play guitar on this album. It's a little like buying your way into one concept of authenticity.
Last night, you seemed to deal with it all right. Girl, you know that I meant well. I promise you that I won't tell. Your touch is electrical. I'm so susceptible.
Auerbach's challenge as a solo artist is the opposite of Harry Styles. Auerbach is grappling with a need to transcend the self-consciousness of the Black Keys' hipster blues. He does it by immersing himself in other genres of pop music.
I moved from New York with my boogie board and bought a big house on the ocean. Stopped eating meat, I took the shoes off my feet.
Styles and Auerbach could not be more different in where they come from musically, but their new albums meet in a middle ground of forced humility. Trying to convince you of the seriousness of their studies in pop, they drain off the kind of spontaneity that can result in great work, but they manage to fashion a few enjoyable replicas of energetic work.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed new solo albums by Harry Styles and Dan Auerbach. Coming up, we hear from Pamela Paul, the editor of the New York Times Book Review. She's written a new book about her life as a reader. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Our next guest, Pamela Paul, is the editor of the New York Times Book Review and oversees book coverage at the Times, which is to say, she's surrounded by books. This seems like a great job for someone who read so much as a child that by the age of 10, she asked repeatedly if she could get a job at her local library. When Paul was 17, she decided to give up writing a diary and instead keep a list of all the books she read. She's been updating that list ever since. She calls it BOB, B-O-B, the acronym for her Book of Books. Now Pamela Paul has a new memoir about her lifelong relationship with books. It's called My Life with Bob, Flawed Heroine Keeps Book of Books, Plot Ensues. She spoke with Fresh Air's Sam Brigger, who produces all our book interviews.
Pamela Paul, welcome to Fresh Air. You say that over the years, revealing the fact that you had a Bob to other people could be a dicey proposition, that some people just didn't understand why you were writing down all the books you'd read.
Yeah, well, some people really didn't like the fact that I wasn't writing more than that. I remember one boyfriend in particular just thought it was worthless without sort of having an essay accompanying each entry about what the book meant to me and my personal reflections. And I felt terrible once he leveled that criticism. And I started keeping a book like that. And that book lasted for 2 entries. Mm-hmm. And the relationship didn't last much longer. And then I wrote about this in the New York Times Book Review in 2012 in an essay on the back page. And the reactions I got were really interesting, and they kind of fell into 3 categories. One was, you know, wow, I wish I'd done that, and sort of filled with regret that people hadn't done it. The second was that kind of a little bit annoyed that it wasn't something more than what it was. Then the third one was, I do that too. And of course, those were the best. And a lot of those responses came via email, but also in snail mail. And some people sent in, you know, images from their own book of books.
Huh. That's interesting.
Nobody knew that anyone else did that kind of thing.
Yeah. So did you have trepidation about writing about it for The New York Times when you did?
Oh, my God. Are you kidding? Yes. Yes. Anyone can see it. And it's totally embarrassing because it includes things, you know, high-minded things like Faulkner and Joyce. But it also includes like a memoir by the roadie from The Doors, you know, and like really real teenage fare.
Well, you're not only a voracious reader, but you also like the physical aspect of books. And, you know, of course, of your position at the New York Times, you have access to a huge amount of free books. You write, like all collectors, I exist in a perpetual state of want that bears no reasonable relationship to the quantity of unread books mounting up on my shelves. How do you feel about having books on your shelves that you haven't read? Does that stress you out?
It doesn't stress me out insofar as I continue to believe, again, this might be naivete, but I believe that there is a future there for me when I'm done with everything, you know, like every box is checked off somehow and my days are now empty and all I get to do is read and watch movies. That's probably completely delusional, but I continue to have it. And that state of want and deprivation really stems from what I felt like was a really book bear environment growing up. We didn't have a lot of books in the house growing up because we lived so close to the library. Whenever I wanted a book, the answer was, you know, get it from the library. And I had a really meager allowance, even for the time. My allowance for a long time was a dime a week, which, you know, really doesn't go far.
It
doesn't take you much beyond like Tootsie Rolls. So getting a book was like a really big deal for me. And I would save up as a child to buy used Nancy Drew's from a local used bookstore. And I think that was the moment, those were the books that made me really think of the book as an object, because there are many different editions of Nancy Drew's even at that time, and there have been a bunch subsequent which like modernized the illustrations and whatnot. But I only liked a particular version. To me, like, it's just without question the best. They have yellow bindings, yellow spines. I have talked to people who disdain that particular those particular editions for the earlier blue ones, but mm-hmm. the blue ones to me were too old. They were not in nice enough state when I was growing up. I wanted those yellow ones, and I did not want the modern paperback ones with the new, you know, sort of hipper illustrations. Those to me were just so completely subpar.
Well, let's talk about your job. You are the editor of the New York Times Book Review, and you also oversee book coverage for the entire paper. How is it decided what books get reviewed for the three permanent reviewers at the news organization?
So there are two very different systems between the Sunday Book Review and the Daily Critics. And they're kind of opposite in a way. With the critics, the chief critic is Michiko Kakutani. She gets the first crack at the books. And she really decides what it is that she wants to review. So you begin with the critic. With the book review assignments, we start with the book. And when we have a book, we are one of the most creative things after deciding which books deserve a review or not. The next big decision, and this is one that I'm very involved in, is who should review it? And that is a really interesting process. Sometimes we know, or we're pretty confident, that one of the critics will review it. So we know, okay, if Michi is going to review this book, what might we do that's different if we think that there should be a second review? Mm-hmm. Who should review it that would provide a different take? Maybe it is an established book critic. Maybe it's a novelist or a poet. We had Bill Clinton review the fourth installment of Bob Caro's LBJ biography. We have had Patti Smith review a Murakami novel. Paul Simon reviewed Stephen Sondheim's memoir. That's the part that's sort of the most delicious and creative, mm-hmm. because you just think, like, who would I most want to read on this book? And then also, who would New York Times readers most want to read on this book?
How do you deal with a situation when you're looking at a book that has a particular political slant and you have to choose who to review it? Do you sometimes, like, you probably don't want to just choose someone who completely agrees with that, or on the other side, you don't want to deal with someone who's just going to be opposed to it?
Yeah, those are tough assignments. And I personally find them among the most challenging, but I think also among the most exciting and interesting, because we don't believe in a setup review where you sort of hire someone you know is going to do a takedown because they're on the other side. And on the other hand, you don't want this sort of just sycophantic agree, you know, I love this person because I vote the same way kind of review. So we try to find people that we know are fair and independent-minded and able to assess a book on its merits. And, you know, what has become more difficult about that is that, particularly in these highly partisan times, people are very much set in their, you know, own camps. And it's hard to find. I mean, there are certain reviewers that people that we miss. I mean, Christopher Hitchens, for mm-hmm. example, he reviewed a lot for us, and he's someone who he's irreplaceable as a writer and as a critic, but you never kind of knew what his take would be because he so often was contrarian and surprising. Mm-hmm. Michael Kinsley is a bit that way. There are some critics out there who we don't know what they'll think, and so that's always interesting. And in general, I would say, especially for fiction, we try to find someone who we think will be open to a book. We're not trying to find people who are going to take down a book because, generally speaking, when we assign a book for review, we're doing that because we, the editors, think this is a book that's worthwhile. Mm-hmm. We think, you know, of all the books out there, and we assign, you know, only about 1% of those books published in a given year, that of all the books out there, this is one that matters. This is one that is either a new voice or an author people care about or should know about.
Well, have you ever commissioned a review from someone and they send you back some sort of takedown and you find out afterwards that they have a personal conflict with the author?
That has happened. And with luck, we really do try to suss out any kind of conflict of interest beforehand. And it's not always possible. And certain people have different standards from our own about what a conflict of interest might be. Mm-hmm. There are other publications, I won't name any, that, you know, we can see people reviewing books that we turned down as assignments because we felt there was a conflict of interest, and then we see it run elsewhere. So we know that not everyone has the same standards as the Times. And that's not to say that we don't make mistakes or that we don't find things out after the fact. And if we find out before the review runs, we'll kill it. And that's something that we never want to do, because that's a lost opportunity then for that author. There are some books that never got reviewed because we found out that there was a conflict of interest. And by the time we found it out, it was sort of too late to reassign it elsewhere. And again, it's pretty funny sometimes what people don't consider to be a conflict of interest. I've asked people to review something and they've said, oh, I'd love to review that. I gave it a great blurb and I'd be happy to write a full review, yeah. Which, of course, you know, you can't do, or they share an agent. There was one person, I mean, it was pretty funny email, I have to say, in which they were like, oh, yes, you know, I totally could review this book. I did used to live with this person, but we're no longer sleeping together and it's fine. I could, you know, completely independently assess it. And that's a true story.
Well, what's your take on blurbs? Because we've had an experience here at least once where there was a positive blurb about a book by someone, and then we found out that it was taken completely out of context, and the person otherwise thought that the book was suspect.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we can see blurbs from our own reviews. Like, okay, so there's a difference between blurbs and sort of the extractions from a review that you'll see on an ad. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you'll have like a really nasty negative review of a book, but there might be a sentence in which they say, you know, this is a pleasure in its despicability or something. And then the quote will be a pleasure, you know, in the ad. So, you know, there's a lot of creativity around that. There could be a whole thing about blurbs. At the Times, journalists at the Times are not allowed to blurb books. Hmm. And I think that that's for a good reason, because it does end up posing a lot of conflicts of interests for us as writers and reporters and editors to sort of be publicly endorsing books before they come out.
So you write in your book that when you were asked to write your first book review, and I don't know if this was for The Economist or not, you handed it in and your editor said something like, oh, dear, let me show you yes. how to write a book review. So what did they teach you?
The thing about a book review, it's a very particular form of writing, and not everyone knows how to write it. And one of the stunning things as an editor is to see many excellent writers, you know, whether they're a novelist or a poet, hand in a book review and you're like, wait, what? You're such a good reporter or novelist or short story writer. Like, how could you have handed in this like thing? You didn't even tell me, you know, whether the book was good or not. So there are a lot of different ways to write a book review, and you can write it very formulaically, sort of ticking off all the things that you're supposed to do in a book review, which is, you know, give a sense of what the book is about, but don't reveal too much of the plot. Quote from the text so people can get a sense of what the writing is. You know, people want to know what the voice sounds like, how the, you know, sentences are structured. Let people know, readers know, what the author does well and what they don't do well. If someone is coming out with a biography of Jefferson, who has been written about before, there have been previous biographies of Jefferson, you want to know, well, why this biography of Jefferson? What did the historian or the biographer know or find, do you know, do get research on that hasn't previously been uncovered? What kind of research did they do? Do they have a different argument? Is this a new assessment? You want to know about access for books that required, again, a lot of interviewing. Were they, if it's a biography of someone who's alive, did they have access to that person? Was it an authorized biography or not? And you want as well for something a little bit more ineffable, which is you want to feel as a reader that the reviewer engaged with the work. You know, I hate something that feels like a phoned-in book report. And that's something, too, a lot of people don't know the difference between a book report and a book review. They don't know what a literary criticism is in a scholarly journal versus literary criticism in a newspaper book review. And so a lot of it is, you know, there are certain things to sort of tick off. And then there are certain ways to mess with that formula. I mean, one of my favorite book reviews was that I edited was by a review by Michael Lewis of Timothy Geithner's memoir. And the first sentence was something like, he's written a good book. Let's get that out of the way. You know, so right at the top, he's sort of telling you, like, this book is good. And you'd be amazed by how many reviewers, even reviewers who write a very positive review or withholding of their praise. Mm-hmm. There are many instances in which someone hands in a book review and you read it and you think, like, I can't tell if they like this or not. But in the email, they're like, this was such a wonderful book. Thank you so much for assigning it. I loved X, Y, and Z. And you think, well, why did you not say that in the book review? Those were a few of the things that I really did not know before I'd written book review of my own.
Well, I know your husband has followed your lead and has his own version of Bob called Blob, which is the big list of books. Have your kids taken up their own lists?
They have, but they don't keep it as well as I think they should. And I don't want to be too, I don't want to berate them for it, because I think that keeping a book of books should be voluntary and a pleasure. To me, reading is something that you get to do, not something that you have to do. And I wish that schools and teachers and parents sort of thought of it more in those terms, because I think that, that's infectious. And one of the things that we've done with our kids is, like, they have two bedtimes. So The early bedtime is, like, if you just want to go to bed, like, your bedtime's, 8 o'clock. But if you want to stay up and read in bed, you can stay up until 8:30. And, to me, like, if someone had said that to me when I was a child, like, I think I would have passed out from happiness because, when I was a kid, you went under your covers with a flashlight and read because you weren't supposed to do that. So I feel like I'm like, reaching into the cookie jar for my kids and passing out the goodies.
Well, Pamela Paul, thanks for coming on Fresh Air.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Pamela Paul spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. Paul is the editor of the New York Times Book Review and author of the new book, My Life with Bob, Flawed Heroine Keeps Book of Books, Plot Ensues.